So for a while, what the Gemara is doing is the Gemara is going right on the part of the Mishnah that says that if a person denies Techiyas HaMeisim, or even if I believe in Techiyas HaMeisim, but I believe that there's no source in the Torah for it. In other words, I might believe it's true, but I don't believe it's in the Torah. So such a person, the Mishnah says, does not have a chelik in Olam Haba. And it's a very severe thing. So the Gemara is offering various proofs, various discussions, and the like. So now we're up to a brisa that says Tana Rabbanan, right? The rabbis taught, and this is interesting. This little bit. This is a brisa. You know, people always ask the Gemara. The word brisa, just a little bit of general knowledge. Brisa literally means outside, outside, and it refers to any teaching of the Tanaim that is not in the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah is the inside book, and anything outside of the Mishnah is called a brisa. And we know, of course, there are certain buzzwords that indicate that something is a brisa. The most common word is either Tanya, as opposed to Tanan, or Tanu Rabbanan. That's always a brisa. But people sometimes ask, well, where is the source of a brisa? In other words, brisas are from existing collections that the Gemara is taking from. So where is a, can I get a book of brisas? Is there a sefer? Can I go to the store and get sefer habrisas? Well, you cannot, because brisa is not the name of a book. Brisa is just a negation. Anything that's not a Mishnah is a brisa. But many brisas are toseftas, which appear in the back of the Gemara. Tosefta literally means an appendix or an addition, written by Rav Chiya and Rav Oshia to give you views of Tanoim that explain. Many brisas are halachic midrashim, like the Sifri and the Mechilta. So you can't really tell unless sometimes the on the side it'll tell you where a brisa is from. Other brisas we don't even know where they're from. We don't have the original source. We only know them because they're quoted in the Gemara. Well, the brisa that the Gemara is now going to quote is from a sefer that we do have. It's a very small sefer. And it's called Megillas Tanis, which literally means the scroll of fasting. But it's a bit of a confusing name. Megillas Tanis is actually the earliest written document of Torah Shebal Peh, and it is even earlier than the Mishnah. The Mishnah was completed around 200 of the Common Era. Megillas Tanis is like 100 or 150 years earlier than that. And it's a listing, it's really historical, it's a listing of all the days that you're not allowed to fast or give a eulogy. So Tainus is the other way. It's not telling you when to fast. Unlike Maseches Tainus, which primarily talks about when you fast, Megillas Tainus is a listing of the days you're not allowed to fast or eulogize because they are Yomim Tovim. And there's a large number of holidays commemorating different events during the Second Temple period. But most of those events we no longer keep as holidays. The Gemara basically has a rule in Rosh Hashanah, Maseches Rosh Hashanah, called Batla Megillas Tanis, that the rules of Megillas Tanis are Batel, except for Chanukah. Chanukah is mentioned in Megillas Tanis. That's the one that we still keep today. All the other ones we don't keep. But occasionally the Gemara does quote Megillas Tanis, and it's really technically a brisa, for various reasons, and giving you, as it were, a history of what you might call extinct holidays. Now, when I say it's a holiday, I don't mean it was a Yom Tov. You were allowed to do malacha, but it was a holiday in the sense that you weren't allowed to have a private fast day for a dream or something, nor could you eulogize a mace. If somebody died, you would not eulogize. So here, the Brisa says the following. This is an otherwise unknown holiday, that the 24th of Nisan was a holiday during the Second Temple period, at least during part of the Second Temple period, which means, of course, it's not so relevant for us today anyway, because Lamaisa, we Paskin, you're not allowed to fast or eulogize the entire month of Nisan. So in a sense, you don't need a special holiday on the 24th of Nisan, but the Megillas Tanis says there was a special holiday. Now, why was that so? Tanu Rabbanan, the Esrim, the Arba, the Nisan. On the 24th of Nisan, that's 3 days after Pesach, Isnatilu Dimus Noi Miyehudai Umirushalayim. The complainers and the attackers against Judaism were refuted. Apparently, you'll see in a moment that there was a famous public disputation that could, Chas v'Shalom, have meant that the Jewish people would have suffered a severe loss. and the disputants were defeated on the 24th of Nisan, so that became a holiday. Now, what is the dispute? So the Braisa goes on and says, Kishabo b'nei Afrika, Africa is what it sounds, when a delegation from the African continent came, Lodun im Yisrael, to litigate against the Jews, Lifnei Alexandros Mukdan. Okay, you know what that is, Alexandros Mukdan, Alexander of Macedonia. Remember Alexander the Great, the great conqueror of the ancient world? He conquered the land of Israel as well. He did not destroy the temple. In other words, there was a Beis HaMikdash during his time, but he was the boss. And when he established his reign over Eretz Israel, as well as most of the rest of the world, you know the story. Alexander died very young man. Alexander died 31, 32. And he died because actually he was waging war against part of Africa and he caught malaria. But the legend has it that he was crying. He died out of grief because he was only 31. And he said he has no more worlds to conquer. He had conquered all of the known world. So they came to him, the people from Africa came to him and they said, hey, the Jews are not entitled to have Eretz Israel. Amru lo, they said to him, Eretz Canaan shalanuhi. The land of Canaan, right, that's the original biblical name for Eretz Israel. The land of Canaan belongs to us. Now, their argument is very simple. The Torah calls Eretz Israel Eretz Canaan. Now, who was Canaan? Canaan is a person. Canaan is the son of Ham, right? Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. The Jews come from Shem after a number of generations, right? Shem, 10 generations from Shem. Is Avram Avinu. Yefes is the Greeks and the Romans come from Yefes. Ham, according to our tradition, was the ancestor of the black nations, the African nations, and Ham's oldest son was Canaan. So these B'nai Afriki make the argument that if the Torah calls the land of Israel the land of Canaan, and we are descended from the Canaanites via Ham, then the land should go to us. Okay, because that's why it's called the land of Canaan. Dichsev Eretz Canaan ligvulasahu, Canaan avua dehanuinshi. Canaan is our ancestor. So Alexander apparently was weighing this fairly seriously, because Alexander was going to kind of give the African nations an ownership and of Eretz Israel. But there was a defender of the Jews, a Jewish man who was a defender of the Jews. His name was Gavia ben Pesisa. Now, we don't know if he was a Talmud Chacham, we don't know if he was a scholar, we don't know anything about him other than he was very skilled in these public disputations, and he's mentioned a few times. So, Omar Lu Gavia ben Pesisa l'Chachamim. Gavia ben Pesisa said to the sages, so the Mashmo says he himself was not a sage, Tenu li rishus, give me permission, the Eilech, the Adun Imahem, l'fnei Alexander Smutin, that I shall be able to argue with them in front of Alexander of Macedonia. Im yinatzchuni, and the reason why it's good to send me is because if they defeat me, you can still say, if they defeat me, you can just say to them, oh, a simple man lost to you, meaning let's not try to argue with our best right now. Let's meet argue first, because if I lose, you can say, hedjot, a simple man lost. And if I win, then it's even better. Amar lahem, we could say to them, Torah's motion nitzachtem. You see how true the Torah is, that even a simple man is able to use the Torah to establish the case. Now, again, I'm not sure if he's being modest or not, but at least in terms of his own self-designation, he calls himself Hedyot. Hedyot means a simpleton. So, Nasnu l'rishos. The Chachamim gave him Rishus, Halach v'dani mohim, and he started disputing them. Amar lahem, Meheichan atem mevi'in raya. Where are you bringing a proof to your entitlement? And they answered the Torah. The Torah calls it the land of Canaan. Amru lo min haTorah. Amar lahem, Afani lo'avi lachem raya ela min haTorah. So I see you accept the Torah. You're using the Torah to bolster your case. Then I will use that same Torah to bolster our case. And that is, what is your argument? Your argument is that Hashem gave Eretz Yisrael to Canaan, and Canaan is the ancestor of the African nations. Huh? But what else do we see about Canaan? Vayomer, Noach said to Canaan, Oror Canaan, cursed be Canaan, Eved Avadim Yiyeh Liachav. Canaan must be a slave to his brethren. So, the same Torah that says Eretz Yisrael belongs to Canaan also describes Canaan as a slave. Now, what is the halacha if a slave acquires property? That's right. So whatever an Eved acquires belongs to the master. So yes, you own Eretz Yisrael, but since you're a slave to us, so therefore what you own belongs to us. Eved shekana nechasan. When an Eved acquires property, Eved lemei nechasan. Who owns the Eved? Who owns the nechasan? Glowot. And by the way, not only don't you get Eretz Yisrael, but we also want to give you a bill. Because here is the problem. These African nations were a mixture of Canaan and Mitzrayim. Both of them are children of Ham. By the way, Egyptians, you know, we were slaves in your land for so many hundreds of years. You owe us some salary, back pay. Actually, this is an issue in the United States where there's a movement for reparations where black groups were seeking compensation for the years of slavery. Lo od, sharei kamashanim shlo avadatunim. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. They're just making the point. No, I'm sorry. He's not making reparations at this point. That's going to be Viter. Because these are the Canaanites. These are not Egyptians. These are Canaanites. But he's simply saying, oh, by the way, we own Eretz Yisrael because whatever a slave owns belongs to the master. And by the way, you haven't been working for us in recent years. So they asked Alexander, make them our slaves. So Amar Lehu Alexander Smokdem. So Alexander of Macedonia said to the other side, Chasiru lo tshuva. What is your answer to them? Umrulo, so they said to Alexander, give us 3 days to figure out an answer. They didn't have any answer. They really didn't have any answer to this argument, so Miad Borcha, they just went back to Africa. And they hoped that Alexander wouldn't go after them. And what it says is, interestingly enough, they abandoned their fields that had been planted. Now again, what fields are these? I'll come back to it. Karmayim and their vineyards, Kishahein the Tuais, which had been planted. In other words, they were in such a rush to get out of there that they actually abandoned planted fields. And that year was a Shemitah year. This passage is a little obscure, exactly what it means. Why did they have fields? I mean, are these fields in Africa? It's not naturally that way. In other words, the Misa seems to indicate that these African people had property they owned in Israel that they abandoned when Gavia started making an argument that they're actually their slaves. They wanted more. They already had something, right? They already had something. That's right. And what the Bryce is telling us is that by abandoning their fields, this actually benefited the Jewish people because it was a Shemitah year. And during a Shemitah year, we're not allowed to plant. So we can only eat the things that grew wild. But Baruch Hashem, here you had all of these goyim that were planting, and they abandoned the fields. So now we had all sorts of food that we were able to eat during the Shemitah year. The Jews' argument is that even if the land belongs to Canaan, but Canaan was cursed by Noah to be a slave. So whatever a slave owns belongs to the master. And therefore, yeah, it is your land, but since you belong to us, what you own belongs to us too. So they didn't know what to say to that, so they just ran away. And in running away, they abandoned all their fields, which was a great bracha because the fields were planted during Shemitah. And that way the Jewish people had something, or many Jews had something to eat during Shemitah that they otherwise wouldn't have. Yeah.
But still the land is in Israel, so even if the non-Jews planted, could we use
it? Well, this is an interesting question. So this actually raises some interesting halakhic questions. And that is, if the land is in Israel, doesn't it still have the laws of Shemitah? And this is a big controversy that arises even today. As you know, the Rabbanut, what the Israeli chief rabbinate does, because so many farmers are not observant, so they don't keep the law of Shemitah. So the rabbanut gets their permission to officially sell the land to a goy. There's some Arab that owns all the land in Israel during Shemitah. And they follow the heter that if the land belongs to a guy, it's allowed to be farmed. Now that's what the Rabbanut does, based on a psak of Rav Kook going back many, many years. Now most of the Torah world does not follow that heter. Most of the Torah world does not say you can sell land to a non-Jew, and they take the position that even if the land belongs to the non-Jew, the laws of Shemitah still do apply. Now here you might say, but wait a second, the Gemara seems to be telling us that because this was a non-Jewish field, but the answer is that the Goyim did what they wanted, meaning to say, it's not that the Jew would not be allowed to work the land. Right. The Goyim did it because the Goyim did it, nobody stopped them. So a Jew can't work the land, but a Jew would be able to eat the fruit that grew on that land, the Ebed, after the fact. Mm-hmm. So that's all it was. In other words, they were able to harvest the land, the property, the payros that grew during Shemitah, even though it was planted on Shemitah itself. And that's the halacha. The halacha, in fact, even if a Jew does that, if I plant my field sinfully, and I'm not allowed to plant, but still people are allowed to eat the fruit that grows. Right? Hmm. There's a diyeben and a lechatchila in these halachas. So that was round number one with Gavia ben Psisa.
So why were the Africans in Eretz Yisrael? Was there migration?
Yeah, apparently there was migration, just as, you know, the truth is there, you know, Africans, other people, Filipinos, there are a lot of different people who come to Eretz Yisrael. Remember, Alexander had one empire, so people could move freely from one country to another. So once they were here, they decided, maybe we can make an argument to get more, and eventually they just left. Now, some Mefarshim do learn that they abandoned their fields in Africa, but that frankly doesn't make a lot of sense. How would the Jews, you know, how would they get that during Shemitah? They travel to Africa, you know, to get it. So it's more Mistavra, the simple shot of the Gemara, that they had some fields in Eretz Yisrael. By the way, Alexander has a connection to our street, Shimon HaTzadik Street. Right? Shimon HaTzadik was a great Kohen Gadol at the time of the Bayis Sheni, the second temple, and at one point Alexander wanted to destroy the Beis HaMikdash because he was convinced by enemies of the Jews that the Jews are using the Beis HaMikdash as a fortress or a rallying point to revolt. And when he came to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, Shimon HaTzadik came out to beseech him. And when Alexander saw Shimon HaTzadik, he got off his horse, which is also a famous legendary horse, whatever, and he bowed down and he said, "Oh, you are the man I see in my dream that tells me I'll be victorious in war and has told me not to destroy the city, and I thought it was just a dream, but now I see it's from Hashem, that you were Hashem's Navi. And because of that, he spared Yerushalayim, and it is recorded there that every Jewish boy that was born that year was named Alexander in commemoration of that event." And that is how the Greek name Alexander became a name that you call people to the Torah. Alexander is a Jewish name. But how did it become a Jewish name? It's a Greek name. Because that's how it entered the Jewish people. Because for that whole year, every boy was named Alexander.
And the fact that he was over the borders or didn't know?
Well, apparently, since it was to commemorate a miracle, it didn't matter. Just as, for example, the months of the year are taken from Babylonian names, and some of them are Avodah Zarah. The month Tammuz. Tammuz is the name of an idol, a Babylonian idol. So apparently, that you see Beferish in Yecheskel, that Tammuz is an Avodah Zarah mamish. But since this is to commemorate Hashem's miracle, so you're allowed to use that name.
Yeah. So what are the original months?
The original months, as far as we know, don't really have names. They're similar to the days of the week, right? What is the name for Sunday? First day, Yom Rishon. So in the Torah, everything is just Nisan is first month, Iyar is second month. In other words, you count the months from Nisan, and they only have numbers because every time, just like every time you say a day of the week, you think about Shabbos, first day toward Shabbos. So every time you count the months, you think of the month of Nisan. Not that it was called Nisan. Now, Nisan is first month. That's why we have the oddity that the month which we celebrate as Rosh Hashanah is actually called in the Torah the seventh month. We're the only religion that celebrates the beginning of the year in the seventh month, not the first month. Because Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei. Tishrei is the seventh month. So there really were not any names of months until we left the Babylonian exile, when we incorporated Babylonian names to remember God's chesed in redeeming us from the Babylonian exile. Okay.
We still have Megillas Tanis, like, in existence?
Yes, we do, we do. We're not entirely sure if we have the original, because essentially we worked backwards. People compiled Megillas Tanis from all of the references in the Gemara. But yeah, there is Megillas Tanis, a very, very interesting historical book. In fact, I can show you, I recently bought myself a Megillas Tanis, like, two big volumes. Now, Megillas Tanis itself, it's funny, Megillas Tanis itself is probably the equivalent of two pages. it's a two-page sefer, but with commentaries and with Maran Makamos and everything, so there's like two big volumes. No, let's not say it all. It's a big volume, it's a one volume, but it's a one volume Megillas Tanis. In fact, it's interesting that the Makor for the story of Hanukkah and the miracle of the Neros, which the Gemara tells us, the miracle that the oil, was only enough oil for one day and it burned for 8 days, that is from Megillas Tanis. Megillas Tanis recorded that miracle. In the Book of the Maccabees, which is a big book about the wars against the Greeks, there is no reference to the miracle of the oil. So the whole way we know the miracle of the oil is from Megillas Tanis. So it's a very, very important Makor of many, many things. Sefer Chashmonaim, as it's called, does not tell you the miracle of the Neros. It only records the military victory. Okay. So now we're going to have a second argument. And this does not involve the Bnei Afriki, who come from Canaan. This involves Mitzrayim. Now, Mitzrayim was another son of Ham. But here's their argument. Shuv Pam, there was another time, Bo Bnei Mitzrayim, Lodnim Yisrael, Bnei Alexandrus Mukden. The Egyptians came. Now, Alexander was from Greece or Macedonia, which is adjacent to Greece. But he did build. He was very, very connected to Egypt. He built one of the great, great cities of the ancient world, which still exists. And quite logically, it was called Alexandria. Alexandria was built by Alexander the Great, and it was kind of his capital city. So the Egyptians came to Alexander, Umrullah, and they said to him the following. Hey, we have a claim that when the Jews left Mitzrayim, they borrowed from us gold and silver and precious garments. They borrowed from us. We never got it back. We'd like a bill, or like to be compensated for all of the precious things that they borrowed. Harehu Omer, it says in your own Torah, Hashem nasan eschena am b'yenei Mitzrayim. God put the favor of the nation in the eyes of the Egyptians. Vayashilum, and the Egyptians lent them all these things. Tanu lanu kesef zahav shenatalta mehem mimenem. Give us back all the gold and the silver that you took from us. So now we have the same response. Amar Gevia ben Pesisa lechachamim. So Gevia ben Pesisa said to the sages, Tanu li rishus, give me permission. V'yelech the Yadun Imahem Lifnei Alexandrus, that I can go and debate in front of Alexander. Im Yenatzchuni, if he wins, not he, if the Egyptians win, Imrulam, you could say to them, ah, of course you won. We only had a simple man here who's not so great. Meaning if Gavio loses, it's not going to reflect so badly on the Torah. Hedjot Shabanu Nitzachtem, you won over a hedjot. V'imani Anatzeya Chosam. And if I win, Imrulahem, then you should say, Toras Moshe Rabbeinu Nitzachtem, which was the Torah. In other words, he's very modest. He basically says, if I mess up, blame me. And if I'm successful, credit the Torah. In other words, he's not taking credit. He's taking responsibility for the downside, and he's not taking credit for the success. Okay, Nosnu Abishus, they gave him permission. V'halach v'dani mayim, he went and he argued with them. Amar lahem, mehechen atem evin raya, what is the source of your claim? The Torah, like they're acknowledging the Torah. Amar lo min ha-Torah, So Amar Lahem, Afani Lo Yavi Lachem Raya Elamina Torah. I will bring a proof from the Torah as well. Now this is where the reparations, I was going ahead. Because it says in the Torah, now this is actually a pasuk, although it's a little schwer. The amount of time that the Jews dwelt in Mitzrayim was 430 years. I'll come back to the question with that. So he says, well, okay, during all of those hundreds of years, maybe you gave us basic food, but you did not pay us the wages you give to a worker. So here, we'll give you back your gold and silver, whatever that was. And here is a bill for 430 years of servitude for a huge population of 3 million people. Actually, much more than that, because remember that 600,000 men from 20, so if you count the women and the younger ones, you have probably 3 million. But they were only one-fifth, because four-fifths died, right? So multiply that by 15 million over a long period of time. Of course, it's a little more complicated, because you didn't have that size population over the whole time, but try to add it up. And sure, we'll give you back your gold and silver. You give us our reparations for 430 years of servitude. Yeah. So Alexander said to the same thing, give him an answer. They said, well, give us some time. And of course, they realized they didn't have any answer. So the same story, it says. They abandoned their fields. Now, this may have been fields in Egypt that were planted, and vineyards, because Egypt is relatively near Israel. And that was a Shemitah year, so people were able to benefit from that. Now, the 430 years is actually a bit of a problem, because we know we have a Masorah. The Torah says 430. In fact, the Torah says there are three time frames in the Torah. The Torah says 430. After we left Mitzrayim, it says we were there for 430 years. When Hashem told Avraham ahead of time that his children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs, the number that's given is 400 years. And then we have a tradition that the actual years of slavery were only 210 years. So how do you reconcile the 210, the 400, and the 430? So actually, the way Rashi explains it, from the time Yaakov came to Mitzrayim till the time Moshe took us out of Mitzrayim is only 210 years. So the Jews were not in Mitzrayim. Even as guests of Paro, they were not in Mitzrayim more than 210 years. And by the way, the slavery was less than that, because the slavery didn't begin till after Yaakov and all of the tribes died. So it's 210 minus. So the slavery was not 210. It's our sojourn in Egypt was 210. So what's the 400? The 400 is from the birth of Yitzchak, that essentially HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham that even when your son Yitzchak is born and he's living in the land of Israel, he will be persecuted and harassed. So from the birth of Yitzchak, which is, Yitzchak never left Eretz Yisrael, from the birth of Yitzchak till Yetzias Mitzrayim is 400 years. From Yaakov's descent to Yetzias Mitzrayim is only 210 years. And the 430 years is from the time Hashem made the covenant with Avraham, telling him about that. Because Avraham had Yitzchak at the age of 100. But the covenant of the parts was when Avraham was 70 years old. So since from Yitzchak's birth to Yetzias Mitzrayim is 400, and the bris, Ben Absarim, was 30 years before Yitzchak's birth, when Avraham was 70, so that's how you get 430. Now, based on that, the emphasis, I have to say, that it seems that Gevi'ah ben Basisa is being a little deceptive here, because Gevi'ah ben Basisa is telling them, since the Torah says 430 years, you owe us a bill, we're going to give you a bill for 430 years of servitude. But according to the interpretation that Rashi offers in Chumash, that's not right. He doesn't have a claim for 430 years of servitude. He doesn't have a claim for 400 years of servitude. And he doesn't even have a claim for 210 years of servitude. It would just be for the number of the years from the death of Yosef and the brothers, which is actually some say around 100 years or so. So L'chayr it's Akasha, because he is relying on a pasuk. Now granted, they didn't believe in the oral law, so they just look at psukim literally. So he's saying, oh, according to the literal psukim, this is what you owe us. But Ali b'Diemus, if this would go to a din Torah, if this would go to a beis din, even if the beis din would award reparation, it would not award reparations for 430 years because we were not there for 430 years. Okay, so it's important to know these three calculations, the 430, the 400, and the 210, and then even less than that, because the slavery did not begin until Yosef and all of the brothers died. We know that Yaakov lived in Mitzrayim 17 years after he came, right? So it's 17 years, and then you have Yosef, and then you have the other brothers, and only then did the slavery start.
Could such a case come before Beis Din? I mean, if the Egyptians came before Beis Din and said this,
Well, the halacha is, would there be a right to reparation? If the Egyptians agreed to go in front of a Beis Din, would there be a right for reparations? I think it's questionable, because Lamaisa, if we had the status of slaves, a slave doesn't get paid for his services, right? So we were slaves. I mean, just like an Eved Kanani cannot go to a Jew and say, pay me for my service, so we wouldn't have the right to do that either. that's true. So you're saying maybe that would entitle them to that reparation. I hear we were being tricked into it. There's like the old story of Tom Sawyer, remember? I don't know if you read Tom Sawyer as a child. He wanted to paint a fence, and he convinced everybody that they would enjoy it, and they wound up doing it. So Chazal say was a very similar thing with Paro, that the Egyptians were working along with the Jews, and it looked like everybody's working together, and then eventually the Jews were painted into a corner that they were stuck. Okay. Maybe we'll stop and have to leave. But okay, you have a good week, and we'll see them tomorrow. Again, I am still trying to get back to our old schedule, but for now we'll have a share tomorrow, and Tuesday we'll be off. Okay.
What essentially in all these stories of people who are not Jewish and who seemingly don't believe in the Torah coming with Torah sources?
Yeah. So there's two ways of understanding it. One is that they believed that the Torah was legitimate. The other is that even if they didn't believe in the Torah, but they're basically saying, since the Jews believe in the Torah, so they're bound by it even if we don't follow it, and therefore the Jews have to follow what the Torah says. Okay.